woke up this morning with the sun down shining in him.
Where's the money, Lebowski? Where's the f***ing money, head?
It's down there somewhere. Let me take another look.
I found my mind in a brown paper bag, but then...
106 miles to Chicago. We got a full tank of gas, half a pack of cigarettes. It's dark, and we're wearing sunglasses.
Hit it.
I tripped on a cloud and fell 8 miles high. I tore my mind on a jagged sky.
Okay, you know, you guys aren't privy to all the new so, you know... That's what you pay me for.
I just dropped in to see what condition my condition was in.
Illinois Nazis.
I hate Illinois Nazis.
Now, let's cut to the chase, okay? What are you guys selling?
I lost you $60,000. There is no one who wants to make that money back for you more than I do.
There's just one thing, dude.
What's that?
You have to use so many cuss words.
What the f*** you talking about?
Don't worry, nobody's listening anyway.
I woke up this morning with the sun down.
Welcome over to Sykes and Jacks. I'm Kamal. The Greg Pappas on the board. SP Futures up 26. NASDAQ Futures up 163. Buy the dip. Buy the dip, Greg. What don't you get?
Let's do it.
We needed to do it about 2 o'clock yesterday, right?
Always.
Yeah, always.
Always. Sell in the morning, buy the close.
Absolutely. Do we have Professor Liu?
Good morning.
How are you, bud?
We're doing okay. Dry, very dry up here. We're just not getting much moisture this spring, so I'm kind of amazed we haven't had some serious forest fires. But we're hanging in there.
Remember, only you can prevent forest fires, Smokey the Bear.
And of course, I'm a child of the Vietnam War. And the guys that flew, do you remember something called Operation Ranch Hand?
Why does that ring a bell? The word rings a bell.
Ranch Hand was the defoliation program we did in South Vietnam, where we and areas around the Ho Chi Minh Trail, where we flew a dump. We flew aircraft that sprayed defoliant over wide sections of.
Was that Agent Orange?
Yes. That was part of the Agent Orange thing. So that was Operation Ranch Hand. But on the sides of their aircraft, as they were spraying these forests, was a picture of Smokey the Bear, and it said, only you can prevent forests.
Ah. quite classic stuff, eh? I mean, talk about off-topic before we even get on topic. By the way, SP Futures are up 27, as if you are up 173.
Do you know the derivation of Smokey the Bear? You know where he came from? There was a Smokey the Bear.
I thought it actually came from the Forest Service, didn't it?
It did. It was part. So if you live in New Mexico or go down there to Lincoln, New Mexico, Lincoln County, which is in the mountain range, in the Sacramento mountain range on the eastern side of sort of the eastern part of the state. It's actually the middle of the state, but it's the easternmost mountain range. You'll find a monument to him. He was a bear cub that had been badly burned in a forest fire, and they adopted him and just started calling him Smokey. And the people in Washington figured out that, you know what, we could do something with this. And so they created this anthropomorphic bear that with the forest ranger hat on that, you know, became the symbol for preventing wildfires.
Well, I mean, it makes sense, I guess. Do you have any... We're talking about off the top, you had me asking you a question. Somewhere buried in my fine filing system up here was a study. This was done when we first started the show.
Move aside some of the lavish breakfast Stocks and Jocks World Headquarters Breakfast Buffet, and I'm sure you can find it.
That's the truth, but this dude, I don't know if he's an actuary or what he was, we had access to him, but somehow he traced like the people that had been in Vietnam for whatever reason, one reason or another, be it contractors, be it aircraft repairmen, delivery people, not UPS, but I mean delivery people delivered armed and aircraft and so forth, and not to mention the people in the Army. And he, and it was like, you know, wasn't there like a million people? You know, there was a lot of people who came and went during the, anyway, he somehow did a study where he traced all these people way after. And this had to be, where are we, 2025? I'm going to say this was maybe 2015, 2013, when maybe we started the show. And he did an actuarial study and said there were 325,000 people dead that actuarially shouldn't have been, that just were in Vietnam for something. I mean, it didn't have to be in the Army, where maybe there was, you know, but it was the toll it took on people mentally and physically was, you know, 325,000 people that should have been, you know, age 50-ish, and all of a sudden weren't. They weren't here. Was that, do you think that was some combination of Agent Orange or drugs or mental, or what do you think would cause that?
I honestly have no idea. I'd have to look at the study. I'm always suspect of these wide-ranging studies that, you know, don't without looking at, you know, what they measured and how they measured it and what specifically they were looking at. So basically what this guy did is based on your description is an excess mortality study.
Yeah.
And looked at and said, okay, you know, X number of people should have died. So the question is, was he looking at combat deaths?
It was anybody who came back. So that
people who were there since.
Yeah.
You know, who knows? I don't. I mean, I do know that, or I've read that the number of excess, or a number of studies have shown that the guys who were Vietnam veterans were no worse than, or no worse off on their return on average than, you know, the average male in their cohort. The idea of the, you know, deranged Vietnam veteran, you know, disillusioned, wandering the streets, dissolute, is wrong to the extent that happened more often. But that's the only widespread study I've seen of, you know, of veterans in that area. There's a lot. That doesn't mean it wouldn't be right. There are a lot of environmental issues that, you know, we weren't aware of in terms of exposure to things. This was a huge issue in Gulf War I and to a lesser extent in Gulf War II with regard to things like burn pits and what we were burning and getting rid of and what people were exposed to as a result. I did a Montel Williams show. I'm reaching back now with a bunch of guys who were veterans of Gulf War I and Gulf War II, who had been exposed to, of all things, depleted uranium.
Wow.
And you know, we hadn't done, we used depleted uranium, and I think we still are, in a number of our armor piercing rounds. And, you know, if you, mainly in something like the 25 millimeter chain gun that the Apaches and the Bradleys fired, but also in some tank rounds, and it's used because it's incredibly dense and incredibly hard, and it's a very effective kinetic penetrator for armor, but it, when you hit a target with one of these rounds, the uranium peels off, a small layer of it shaves off as it enters the target, and this stuff, you know, ends up as dust on the battlefield. Well, it is slightly radioactive, but we had no idea that there was enough of this stuff out there that could create a health hazard, and when you see people coming back with all these weird conditions, you and we did after Gulf War I, you start asking questions about why, you know, what were they exposed to out there, and there's a body of evidence. I don't consider it to be overwhelmingly persuasive, but there's a body of evidence out there that said if you inhaled enough of this dust or got it on your skin and didn't wash it off and it stayed there for long enough, but mainly for inhalation, it killed you. Or it gave you know, usually be a cancer of some kind. And this, again, we have no idea about this stuff. The more exotic and different the weapons that we employ and the way we employ them, the more we are seeing exposure to this stuff. And the other issue that is out there is that we're better at detecting it. We're better at tracking these kinds of illnesses. We don't have any idea what the guys in World War II got exposed to or Korea got exposed
to.
Well,
I think one of the things that I noticed, I mean, I actually talk about anecdotal evidence. I know two or three people that just never quite made it back into regular society. One thing I'll say was that virtually everybody I knew that came back from there that had trouble like these few people were consummate smokers.
I did some work when I was a legal intern on the Agent Orange issue. This was in the early 80s. So you had a bunch of guys coming up with odd types of cancers who were claiming that they had been exposed to Agent Orange. And there was virtually no scientific evidence that indicated this was a thing. And so, but it was a very emotional topic, and you know the mainstream press being anti-Vietnam,
it was
a controversial topic in the legal world, but it was very pre-internet, it was a sensational kind of claim, and so the press being anti-Vietnam as they were pushed this idea, they gave these veterans lots of access. There were lots of stories out there, and the Reagan VA, I mean, this was an executive decision, the Reagan VA finally, you know, said okay, because there were a couple of lawsuits, big class action lawsuits, the Reagan VA, you know, said all right, we're going to make an act of grace here, we're not going to fight this, we will categorize Agent Orange exposure as a likely carcinogen, and we'll treat guys who have indications that they were exposed to it. As I said, I was working on the case. I was as an intern. I was working at the Secretary of the Air Force's office, and one of the things that, you know, this federal court said when the VA announced this decision was this is an act of grace by the administration because there is no evidence that this stuff. At least no way at this stage of us breaking out whether it's this stuff that had this kind of an effect or something else. And the smoking was a huge part of this because a lot of these guys were smokers. Now, we may be better at data collection now, and we may be able to break out that it was a combination of smoking and Agent Orange or whatever.
Well, nobody can be dumb enough to think that if you're underneath one of these drops that defoliates a forest, that it's good for you.
Well, my understanding of ranch hand was that they did not spray it on American troops.
Right. Well, I hope not.
They would go through and lay down this, you know, this stuff. The leaves would fall off the trees, and then at some point the Americans would move in. Again, into an area where there was less cover for the Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese regulars, but there was no epidemiological evidence that this stuff, persuasive epidemiological evidence that this stuff was causing the problems that these guys had sometimes years later, and that's the problem with studies like this, and you look around and go, well, was there something, some factor?
Well, this article had no conclusion whatsoever about what it was. It just said this way. It could have been mental. Was a... Because I knew one of the dudes who used to hang around, used to work at one of the bars in the neighborhood, and he was a two or three tour guy. Interesting character. But he never really got back in society. You know, he came back, all his friends were gone, all his girls he used to date were all married. I mean, a lot of guys had... I don't know what syndrome that is, but you just never quite fit back in your age group.
And undateability?
I had that
for years.
But I mean, he ended up being a contractor to put signs on the highway, and he worked in an apartment. But the only interesting part about him, he was by far the best dart player in the neighborhood. So if these teams used to go from bar to bar, you wanted Al on your team. But I mean, he had heart problems when he was like 35, when he got back from NAM. Then they started to get worse and worse. And I know he ended up dying. I went to the wake. Not many people did. But he became kind of a friend of mine because the guy was just in really bad shape. I mean, he couldn't walk down the house the block to work, and he'd be sitting on my porch because he couldn't make it down the rest of the block. He had the obligatory, you know, green coat that everybody in Vietnam all wore. And went to see him in a nursing home out in Elgin where he ended up, I don't know if he'd have made it any further a little bit. There was a huge fight between the Army wanted Illinois Medicaid to pay for the surgery, and Illinois Medicaid wanted the veterans to pay for it, and they hemmed and hawed, and one day the guy was dead. And I wonder, you know, the care. I think the care might be better now. Care was pretty horrible for people 30 years out of NAM. It wasn't the best. I mean, there's a lot of reasons there, and I don't know what kind of the reasons were, but I mean, a lot of guys at Pullman were in NAM, and I used to hear, like, a lot of stories. One of the dudes who was the assistant plant manager, a guy named Ken Mannon, he worked for Lear Sigler. Remember those guys? They're still around, aren't they?
I believe they are.
But he said they used to deliver fighter jets that you could fly. You know, obviously they got there. You'd fly them and they'd land them on these airfields. But you couldn't use them for combat because they still had, even though the Army was now paying for them, or whatever, the Air Force, they didn't have enough electronics in there to make the thing work. And all of a sudden one day, you know, like part of the dashboard on the plane, for lack of a better term, with some of the electronics, like 15 of them would show up. And he'd put the 15 boxes in the Jeep and have to drive somewhere on some road that allegedly was demined and put the 15 boxes in the plane, so those planes were now operational for combat or something, whether it was the radar or whatever the hell it was. And he said the whole place was just a disaster. I mean, they tell you which road was supposedly checked for mines. He said, well, you didn't take that one because you knew they screwed it up. You took the one. He said, during the day, if you're driving along the day, everybody's waving at you. If you're 2 seconds after darkness, people are shooting at you. He said people were leaving their barracks to go to the bar, and if the bar was off base, they're getting shot on the way to the bar. He goes, it was absolutely a disaster. And under any sort of circumstances, there was nothing there. It wasn't almost like a joke, except people were dying.
Well, you saw the inability of the military establishment at that time to adapt to a new war. A new kind of war, and they did not have a good, you know, counterinsurgency program, and we didn't really understand it well. I mean, it's an amazing, and history repeats itself. By the way,
yeah.
It's an amazing kind of analysis. And if you read the military literature from the time, the studies, and I did. I mean, I entered the military in 1973, so the stuff was kicking around. The analysis of how we were fighting this was, you know, there were analyses everywhere, and they all said pretty much the same thing, which was the focus of the U.S. Army was not, you know, Vietnam as a sideshow, and in terms of strategic thinking, we were focused on Europe and the Soviet Union in Europe and fighting this, you know, preventing the overrunning of Europe, and we didn't really put the kind of strategic doctrine in place we needed to deal with a major counterinsurgency, and we weren't politically willing to take the steps to do what it took, and we weren't willing to do it in Gulf War II to take the steps to cut off and limit the ability of the insurgency that were necessary to actually
prevail. Has anybody ever been successful dealing with an insurgency on somebody else's home turf?
Yeah.
Obviously, it's easier in a desert than it is in a jungle. How the hell would you do it in a jungle?
The Brits did in the Boer War in South Africa. They defeated a raging counterinsurgency. They were brutal about it and hard-nosed about it. And you're seeing the Israelis do it in Gaza. And oh. and it's gonna end up, and you're seeing them do it effectively in southern Lebanon. And it's been done in Southeast Asia. I'm trying to remember, the Brits also had a colonial war, and Southeast Asia before the French.
Sort of we can get off this topic in a second, but why did we toss out the leader in Vietnam?
That was the only guy. Why did we assassinate him? Or why did the CIA?
Yeah. I mean, and after him, the whole thing just went down. We had like nobody even on our side. It was an officer.
I don't remember the exact nature of the criticism of him, but he wasn't doing what we were trying to forestall a communist insurgency there, and we weren't doing it very well, and he was the face of our inability to do it properly, and so they removed him. There was allegedly a pro democratic movement. He was a dictator. There was a pro-democratic movement that we wanted to support, that we felt provided a reasonable alternative to Ho Chi Minh and his people. And this guy wouldn't get out of the way, and he had control of the military. And so I think we promoted, I don't think we actually killed him, but we promoted a coup within his government to destabilize it so that he could be removed. I think that's the storyline.
Why do we and maybe others, why do we think that this idea of, as we're seeing the democracy we have here kind of seemingly fall apart, why do we think that we can put a democratic alleged government in a place that has no concept of the loyal opposition, has no concept of leaving office when you lose? How do we just think we drop that on people when they don't feel that way in the first place? They weren't brought up that way.
This goes back to that worldview issue that you very graciously complimented me on last week, because we have people who don't look at the world the way we do, but we assume that they do, and we assume that our values are so persuasive that anybody who sits down and thinks about it for 5 minutes is going to say, "Well, yeah, I want to be like that." And we don't like that ugly American vignette I told you about last week. We don't understand the willpower that people who oppose our values have, and how far they're willing to go to make sure that their worldview prevails. It's one of the difficult things about fighting in the Middle East, for example, or in Central Asia, in Afghanistan. Those were cultures that just our Western values are absolutely inimical to these people. That's one of the reasons.
Well, certainly, the value of life has a totally different view.
Well, it's the value of life. It's the value of people. It's how. It's the idea of having individuals vote for their own destiny. It's the idea that people should be allowed to speak their mind freely. It's the idea that if you want to engage with a vibrant, dynamic economy, you have to allow a wide variation of viewpoints to succeed, and this is absolutely inimical to, well, for example, Islam. Islam, historically, as it's developed, does not do well with that kind of a value system, and I mean, there've been any number of analyses written on this topic that, you know, one of the things that's happening in the Arab world and has been for the last 100 years is an incredible frustration as they look back on a culture that in the medieval period was ascendant and dominant militarily and economically and scientifically, and that has completely collapsed as theocracy takes over and restricts thought. It restricts half the population. And I'm...
Well, it's a religion that has been used...
Islam is completely different from the kind of I think Islam is where Christianity and the modern Western Church was about 1100 or 1200, where you had a complete merger of church and state, and that's one of the great moves of the Renaissance is the separation of church and state and the limiting of the influence of religion, which of course stamps out dissenting voices.
We got a dash.
Islam does not do that.
We got a dash. You got a break. Did you read a book? We'll talk about it after the break. Called Catastrophe. I'm going to have to try and find that and send it to you.
No, not right off the top of my head.
Anyway, we'll talk about it. SP Futures up 28 and SP Futures up 180. Be right back. Stocks and Jacks.
Is your business being challenged by the complexities surrounding healthcare reform or other matters related to human resources management? If so, then Cognos HR can help. A longtime friend and contributor to the Stocks and Jocks radio program, Cognos HR provides its clients with a perfect blend of strategic consulting and day-to-day HR management to drive overall improvement in business performance. Companies that join the Cognos HR family are better able to manage healthcare costs, enhance benefit offerings, and improve employee satisfaction by leveraging our access to Fortune 500 benefits. Our innovative onboarding and payroll technology, along with our constant attention to detail, enables us to provide the highest level of quality service to our clients. Now, your time and energy can be focused on generating business and increasing your bottom line. We'll take care of the rest. For more information, call us at 630-401-8810 or search us on the web at CognosHR.com. Cognos HR, innovation in human resources. Licensed in Illinois and Arizona.
Hello, this is Tom Howe, the Chief. I think most of you know that I'm also the Chief Investment Officer at PTI Securities and Futures. There we invest for and help a wide variety of clients, and you know what? No two are the same. Some have legacy stocks, some concentration issues, some maybe embedded tax issues. The others might need or want some portfolio protection. There could be estate issues or maybe new family members. The point is that we are all unique and the portfolios should match. However, the last several years have seen a relatively one-way market. It seemed that all we needed was to be all in. No protection, no fixed income, just be all in, no matter who you are or what your risk profile or age. Most management firms love that. Take this and like it, no matter who you are. Be careful with that. You are not everybody. I think most see the market view going forward as maybe different than the one looking back, so your portfolio should reflect that. Maybe it's just as simple as your life station has changed. Towards that end, we are accepting some new clients needing a more personal approach and are interested in negotiating the future and not with a portfolio designed for the past. Find me at 312-663-4310. That's 312-663-4310.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right now, right now.
Hello and welcome back to Stocks and Jacks. I'm talking about Greg Pappas on the board. SP Futures up 27.75. NASDAQ Futures up 180. We got Tesla up 28. Greg, how many times is this guy going to be able to BS the world about driverless cars and 2 years later it still is not happening?
I love it.
Why do we believe the same stuff over and over again?
Because the rockets land on their own.
Ah, well, that'll work. Dow Futures down 66. In the Dow, we've got IBM down 10 bucks, 8 earnings last night. The thing always moves like way more than the straddle. Glad we were trying to do a spread in there.
I almost got caught on those too.
Yeah,
and I thought of you, and I'm like, you know what?
We'll lay off. My brother goes, why don't we just lay off IBM? The last five times he's had some huge move.
I almost did it too. I'm right there with you.
But these things are what? They're 1.5 times straddle. I'm going to say that never used to happen. But
would have been ugly.
Oh God, yeah. Over in Europe, DAX up 139.7%. FTSE up 40.5. CAC around up 54.7. Over in Asia, these guys have been all over the place. Now, yesterday, Nikkei only up 38. Boy, those guys are going to be snoozing. 38,143. Hang Seng down 270 after it was up 270 the day before. Shanghai down 22 at its 0.7%, 3280. As those things continue to rock and sock. Yesterday, Dow was down 409, S&P down 53, NASDAQ down 296. We were down more than that. S&P was down 80, so we actually came back quite a bit towards the close. Bonds. This is what's been causing some of the problem, but now they're actually down 5 basis points today, 4.19. The bond down 5 basis points, 2.26. Not sure why they're down, but they are. Japan down 2.8 points, 0.95. Oil up 77 cents, 71.54. Still mired in this low 70s. Brent up 77 cents, 75.73. Natural gas up 3 cents, 2.38. RBOB up a penny, 2.05. Gold, which has been on a tear down a little yesterday, but making a lot of it back today, and up 19 bucks, 27.48. It was up to 27.60 before it dropped yesterday, but now it's trying to make its way back up there. Silver up 39 cents, 34.22, but it was over 35. Copper up 2 cents, 4.35. FX, and this has been causing, well, not the, it's been some of the, euro is down to 107.9. It was 110.5. Well, that's a big move, isn't it, Craig? It's 3% almost. It's about half a year. Yeah, it's like half a year. British pound, not as bad, 129.76, but it was 131. The yen was down to 141. It's back up to 152. So that's another big move there. Bitcoin up 973, 67,212. A lot of stuff. What do you got for us? Traffic, weather, sports. Ooh. Bulls with like five guards on the floor. They lose.
Yeah. Only by, what, 12?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's 636 here in Chicago. We have 40 degrees right now, about a high of 65 today. Mostly sunny, possible thunderstorm tonight. Temperature drops to about 51. Phoenix, 68 right now. Record temps possible, high of 97 today. Traffic, inbound Kennedy from Montrose, 25 minutes. Edens from Lake Cook, 46 minutes. Eisenhower from Wolf, 30 minutes. Dan Ryan from 95th is 20 minutes, and the Stevenson from 294 to the Ryan is 30 minutes. Sports, NFL, Vikings at Rams tonight. That's 7:15. Minnesota favored by 3. NBA, Bulls lost to the Pelicans. That was 111 to 123. Vucevic had a good game, though. That was double-double, 21 and 11. And World Series, game one tomorrow. Yankees at Dodgers. And that's all I got for you, Chief.
They have the defense is described as the Ole defense.
What's that?
The Bulls. Ole.
Ole.
And they only had 20-some turnovers. They couldn't even dribble.
Yeah,
these,
I mean,
these guys
got
30
so close,
points
though.
Off the dribble, off the turnovers.
They sound like a WNBA team.
Yeah, yeah.
A WNBA championship team.
God. Anyway, Lou, this book, talk about somebody who's a, only could be a Brit, right? Talk about a terrier after a bone. The guy comes over. The guy who wrote this book. He goes over to somebody's house, and evidently in some, you know, some form of art or furniture, it's real cool to have like a. It's got to be, what do you figure it is, 3/4 inch, 7/8 horizontal slice of a big huge old tree. Is considered a really good, like, coffee table or something. Put a base.
Oh,
on.
Oh yeah, no, I've seen that before. Yeah,
and evidently, you know, they're pretty cool. Well, the dude is.
If you, they're huge in the Southwest, and if you come out to Denver or go down into, again, New Mexico, Texas, whatever, you'll see these fantastic tables, and they will take a cut of a horizontal cut of a log or a you know, a fallen tree or something like that, and then they will the wood where typically there are cracks in the wood or there's deteriorated portions, they will clear that out. The artist will clear that out and fill it with a turquoise or silver or some other valuable mineral kind of composite. Typically it's fiber, it's some kind of resin or something like that, and they'll fill that in there. So you get this natural wood with these gorgeous, you know, streaks of turquoise color or silver color running through the wood. It's very impressive.
Well, the dude is over at somebody's house, and I don't know if he was so boring nobody wanted to listen to him or whatever, but all of a sudden he starts looking at these things, and every one of the circles is a year, right? It's a year of growth.
A tree ring you're talking about? Yes.
And so he's looking at him, and he goes way back toward the middle, and he sees these, like, 10 or 20 of these years amazingly compressed. And he goes, what the bleep? What happened during those years? And he counts them all down, and he gets somebody with a microscope. Then he goes and finds, like, all kinds of other ones that he thinks. And sure enough, the same 10, 15, 20 years, which corresponds to maybe the late 400s, I think, or the early 500s, somewhere in there. And it starts to do a whole bunch of research, which, of course, there's, like, no written stuff of anywhere, but some people have some stuff. So he starts contacting scientists all over the world. And and to start doing some research. And it turns out in Russia, the people that had horses dominated, you know, the Genghis Khans of the world and people. And all of a sudden, for a 10 or 12 or 15 year period, the people that had cattle dominated. In other areas where the castles were built, you know, on land, all of a sudden were built near where there was water and essentially fish. So the entire, everything changed. And King Arthur's court went down. Some places in Central America and so forth had different huge changes in governance and so forth. It essentially tracks it down. It was a massive time of cold weather. Brought upon, eventually he reaches the point where he gets so far with this thesis that the Royal Air Force or somebody gains enough interest in it. And I think they ended up finding some massive volcano somewhere that just erupted for like years, and the water would pour in it, and the entire world was under essentially an ash cloud, and the temperature dropped God knows what enough to where. So anyway, this whole time is when, and there's a chapter you don't want to read, Luke. It has to do with how bubonic plague essentially got out of Central Africa. Bubonic plague was essentially one of these. What's the one where you bleed out everything?
It's a hemorrhagic. All these diseases
are like contained in these caves in Africa, right? And once in a while, one gets out.
A number of them are. Some of them escaped from labs in China.
Well, yeah, I knew you were going to say that. If you didn't, I was going to. But
there are Asia is another area, hotbed area where these things come out of. So,
well, don't people get these huge hazmat suits and go to these caves on like the one of those rivers over there and grab the bats and find out what's new in the disease world?
That's one source. I mean, a number of hemorrhagic fevers have come out of there, but also a number of flu-type, coronavirus-type stuff comes out of Asia. The African stuff is sort of native-born, and then it has a, because of the closeness of affiliation of people with animals, it'll jump. In Asia, it's a result in many cases of agriculture, but where you know, domestic animals are exposed to some kind of a virus that then makes the jump from the domestic animals to people.
Well, anyway, the bubonic plague normally was locked in some area, and because of the cold weather, the guy traced how the hell he did this, Lou. I have no idea. I'll stop talking about this in a minute. But he essentially traced. There's a bunch of rats that are indigenous to that area. For whatever reason, there's a million different species of rats. I couldn't tell you. Although, were you on the Spirit Airlines plane yesterday with the rat running around in a light fixture?
No, but
you heard that?
We talked about Spirit Airlines a couple of weeks ago. Yeah.
Well, anyway, this particular species of rat that would normally have the bubonic plague, because of the cold weather, made it another 5 miles further than they normally do. To where ran into another species of rat. And anyway, he's tracing all these rats. They basically make it to the sea. So there now are rats that have bubonic plague that are near where the ports are, and they hop on the ships, and they get carried to Europe. So that's how bubonic plague basically got to Europe. So the Roman Empire is at the death's door, which it wasn't before. It surely was. Now everybody's got the bubonic plague. So at the same time, Muhammad ends up with this new religion. And the religion basically at that time was, there's all these weak areas. Our religion is better than those guys. We're going to use religion as a way to go essentially get those guys, sort of like the Catholics did in the Crusades.
Muhammad. The Crusades were a reaction to Muhammad and his conquering territory, but Muhammad's religious theology or his theological worldview was from the very beginning that God said, go out there and proselytize with the sword.
Well, he wouldn't have been able to do that if the Romans weren't so weak. According to this guy, he wouldn't have been able to do that. if the Romans weren't so weakened by the plague. And evidently his dad had nothing.
So what time frame? You know what time frame you're talking about?
Was the late 400s somewhere?
No. Everybody should know this. Muhammad was active in Medina and then in Mecca up until like 620 to 632 or
right, maybe I was off 150 years or so, somewhere back in those dark ages. Yeah, you're right.
Well, yeah.
But his old man had a lot of money, right? According to this guy.
Yes.
Yeah, his old man had
his wife's father, I believe, had a lot of money.
That's why people listened to him, because the old man had a bunch of grain, right? Sort of.
Well, he gave those very scattered, what were at the time Bedouin kind of tribes, a overriding theology that allowed him to unite them. And if you read this history, and then you go read a modern science fiction classic like Dune, I mean, it's kind of based on this, and the rise of an emperor god. That was, Muhammad didn't make himself God, he just made himself a prophet. But his theology piggybacked on the traditional Abraham story from the Old Testament, and then expanded it. God was talking to him, and gave him a real sort of link. Obviously a very charismatic guy, but gave him a link to a worldview that again allowed him to unite these disparate tribal groups into a very effective fighting force.
Well, it also was
a very active one.
According to my religion, they got it, we want it, we can take it. That was part of the deal, right?
I mean, that's a little simplistic, but it's not they want it, we want it, they've got it. It's more like God has a worldview that requires us to convert people, and it's okay if we convert them by the sword. It happens to allow for the accumulation of wealth in women, which is always handy.
Oh yeah,
I mean it's he's sort of. You look at the history of that, and then you see elements of it in things like modern Mormonism, where Joseph Smith is a prophet. God speaks directly to him. He at some point becomes enamored. He's married, but at some point becomes enamored of his 15-year-old housekeeper. And the next thing you know, God's telling him, Joe, it's okay if you have a few wives. You can have more than one wife.
And why would anybody?
And that's okay.
Why would anybody want that?
I think it's hard enough maintaining one, but
yeah.
if you have a culture where the women in the culture have been raised on this polygamous mentality, then everybody makes it work.
Well, I like the part where if you get like five or six, then
jackpot.
Then one of them has to be in charge of the rest, right? Soldiers.
That's one of the ways the Mormons have organized it. Yeah,
I thought the Mormons was strictly so many guys had gotten persecuted in Pennsylvania, Illinois. They didn't have enough guys left. I thought it was very practical. It wasn't
Well, that may have been a post hoc justification, but the origins of the story are Joseph Smith had a revelation that God told him that it's okay to be like the guys in the Old Testament with multiple wives, and it directly links to him becoming enamored with his housekeeper, who was a 15-year-old girl. And this, in polygamous societies, at least in the West, this is always the way it works out. You have these dirty old men chasing after these nubile young girls, and if you look at the polygamous enclaves out in southwest Colorado and southeast Utah, northern Arizona, northwest Arizona, that Four Corners area, you find this. And what they do is they end up driving the young men out of the organization, or out of the tribe, because the young men are obviously more attractive to young women, and they take young women off the marketplace.
Oh, God.
It's horrific. Anyway, it's interesting. You see the look. We want to be able to do this, and the next thing you know, God's telling you to do it. Funny how that works.
I don't know. Boy, one girlfriend's more than enough. One wife, I think, would be more than enough too.
I don't run in these circles, but maybe Greg does. None of my friends at the age that I'm at now have the energy for this. But are we seeing some kind of increase in polygamous kind of, I won't say polygamous marriages, but polyamory? You know what that term is, right, Tom?
I get the feeling, we'll let Greg answer, but that...
Wait a second.
Well, because you know what I'm saying? I see an awful lot of people that don't... They're not exactly dating. They're not getting married. They're all just kind of hanging together. It seems like there's not an individual person that has a girlfriend or a boyfriend. There's this groupthink. I don't know what they're doing.
A polyamorous relationship is a relationship in which you have two people who are, quote, committed, unquote, to each other, either by marriage or some kind of long-term partner relationship, but who allow or are okay with each other going and having sexual relationships with other individuals.
I've heard several of that where the lady has relationships with other ladies as well as the guy.
Well, that's one variation of it.
I haven't heard of the other where they both just swing with other guys and other girls. I'm sure it's around, but that was around when we were kids, younger.
Well, yeah, but it's more formalized now. I mean, now instead of people doing it kind of quietly, now it's you hear, and it, the New York Times was running a bunch of stuff on it for a while, and of course, it seems I don't see how that works, and I don't because. I don't understand the dynamics of the relationship, unless you are kind of psychopathological or sociopathological, and that you don't have relationships with people and they don't mean anything. It's just
another week we should talk about this a little bit more. For some reason,
anyway, we wanted to hear from Greg.
I know, but there is an assault on the male. I think a lot of that flows from there.
I agree with that.
Greg, you talk. What are you thinking? What are you seeing?
I haven't seen that in... I mean, looking at the New York Times, maybe, you know, whatever they've got in there pushing polyamory, or that's kind of its own thing. Maybe in the ultra-liberal, you know, classification.
Oh, you're definitely... It's definitely pushed as you don't want to be open-minded.
Yeah, and I haven't really seen it. Maybe Gen Z is more, but the millennials, not. I'm not going to say we've grown out of it, but it's smaller than the media makes it appear.
I don't see how when you read a lot of these accounts, it's really funny because the New Yorker has a...
I think the best example of kind of what you guys are talking about is the current thing with the Housewives of Utah or whatever, where they got in the big scandal and they were swingers, or soft swinging is what they called it.
What does that mean?
And I don't know. But there was this big thing that these
popular...
What,
it means you only get to second base.
It's this popular group that was on either TV or had their own type of reality show, and then I think one made a confession, and then that threw the whole thing, you know, for a loop, and then some of them got divorced, and they're probably, I don't know, they're not even 40, but they're rich, and I think in Utah, and they were calling them like the Mormon housewives or something. I'm not sure what's true, but...
Oh, God, I can only imagine.
Big stir, but the key term was soft swinging.
You know, triggered...
Should we link that in the show notes?
Yeah. What triggered this was just the thought that an article that I'd read by this woman who said, you know, we had this kind of relationship, we opened up our we'd been long term partners, we opened up our relationship, and you know, my boyfriend of like 10 years, who, you know, we'd been monogamous, my boyfriend of like 10 years left me, and you know, the comments to the article are, what did you, so you're in a monogamous relationship, and rather than work through those issues and have the tough conversations about whatever, you decide, well, sleeping with other people would be helpful and would open our minds. And, you know, I'm sorry, I think that's a distinctly feminine way of looking at this thing. And you know, the boyfriend goes out to Arizona and some kind of a long-term hike, like a 2-week-long hike, and you know, meets some woman, and then they connect, and the next thing this woman back home knows, he's calling her saying this isn't going to work,
see,
and I'm going to go with somebody else. The people writing the comments on the article go, what did you expect? And that's kind of the way I look at it. I don't understand how this doesn't all end in tears, as Greg noted.
I have a couple of family members, one who's still alive. It's maybe on his third person. And he absolutely will tell you right to your face that I got to the point where I like to go out and meet people and do stuff, and my wife decided she's not coming. She just wants to stay at home, doesn't understand why I need to leave the house. And sure enough, he goes, I'm at the movie some afternoon by myself, and I meet somebody. You know, I mean, a lot of it has to do with lifestyle. A lot of it could be the other way. The guy could be sitting, God, doing God knows what, planting flowers. And, you know, I mean, it people change, and you sort of have to change. Like you say, well, Lou, you gotta roll with it, or else you got trouble.
But I don't understand why somebody would have the expectation that this can develop with, or this can operate with, no problems or no change in the underlying relationship without the people being involved being pathological in terms of their personalities. I had a case one of these isolated Air Force bases up in Alaska where they were engaged in what I would refer to loosely as wife swapping, which would be effectively polyamory. You know, a group of about 20 people, 20 couples.
Bob and Carol and Ted and Alice.
Well, a number of people. And so this goes on for, I guess, a year, where they were having the key, you know, the house key or car key parties, and people would go home with each other's wives or whatever. And of course, what happened was, you know, after experimenting through this, a number of people, both genders, suddenly decided that they were in love with the other spouse, you know, not their own. And the idea that you could engage in this kind of intimate contact and not have these kinds of feelings develop, I think, again,
well, you should, it's going to go one way or the other. You're either going to be, well, the grass really isn't greener on the other side of the fence, I'm going home.
That's right.
Or it is greener, one or the other.
That's right, it is. And so once that happened, the whole, as Greg described, the whole thing fell apart. I mean, these people said, well, you know what, I don't necessarily want to, I found the person that I want to stay with now. It's not my husband, it's not my wife. And I'm not interested in
well, people
doing
change over
further.
Years and years and years. I got two questions I want to ask you. One is about
the whole thing. I mean, it ended up in a giant mess of divorces and recriminations and God knows what.
A lot of work for the legal beagle guys.
That's right. The lawyers had a field day.
I got two questions for you. One about is a really stupid question about society, because you were the one. And one is about politics in this election. And that so much as who's doing what, where, and who we're all for, but just to try and tie it back to the economic piece that we always talk about on the show. But the first question is, you always talk about, or you have talked, and you used to accuse Mattie Weber of being a moral relativist. And when you talk about, if you live in Chicago now, which I'm not saying you should, the whole idea that people get to decide which rules you feel like following. But not only that, you also get to tell the people that you to follow those rules and other rules you don't. I'll give you an example. I was going to get lunch for my workers on Saturday, and I said this the other day. I pull out an Armitage. There's this lady coming by, and very attractive, and I'm sure she must have had a book somewhere of how she could possibly get into those biking shorts, because it looked to me like they were like painted on. But that's another story. Very attractive, maybe mid-30s, and some guy is trying to pull into this parking place. The guy in front of him didn't move, so he's kind of in the the bike lane for like a couple of minutes. She goes up to him as the open window, bitches this guy a blue streak about what a cat he is for being in her bike lane. Okay, fine. You know, I guess people have this. So then there's a stop light, and in the next block there's a stop sign. Well, she goes right by all the cars and blows right through the stop sign. So I'm sitting there now, okay, one rule affected you positively. Now, that one should be absolutely enforced, and this guy should be, you know, taken out and flogged. But now you don't think the stop sign is for you. You just go right through. That's okay. Is that endemic in our society? I mean, that's not healthy to me, Lou. It doesn't seem healthy. I don't know what I can do about it, nothing, but it's what I think you've talked about. People decide they can do whatever they damn well please, and the laws are enforced in such a ridiculous way now that, in some states anyway, that you can do whatever you damn well please. That was like question number one. And question number two regarding the election, and I know we got to dash to Dan here in a second, but he's listening probably. Regarding the election, we have two people that appear totally opposite ends of the spectrum. And yet,
well, one's Hitler.
Well, whatever.
Adolf Hitler's apparently been resurrected.
Well, I mean, it doesn't help when you start talking about how idiot your generals. But I'm saying this is kind of a simple question, Olu. Despite what you think are the differences between them, personalities and so forth, which I think there probably are, but the last two administrations, if you look at any of the numbers, like the oil production, you look at any of the deficits. Look at the money supply. You look at the inflation. They're attached at the hip in terms of what happened in the last 8 years. So my question is, regardless of the personality, regardless of one's Hitler and one isn't, whatever that kind of crap, how boxed in are both of these people for the next 4 years, because the numbers don't lie? I don't see how there can be much difference really in policy, because they are absolutely backed into a corner by what they both did in the last 8 years, or am I just totally off on this?
Well, let's just real quick. The economic issues are predominant because the people vote their pocketbooks, but that's not the reason I look at this. I think people are looking at the things they do have control over. I think they're looking at boys being allowed into girls' locker rooms and playing on girls' sports teams. I think people are looking at that. I think people are looking at the suppression of speech that government officials don't like on things like Twitter and Facebook and other social media, and the basic, what, you know, Justice Neil Gorsuch called the greatest infringement on civil liberties in our history outside of wartime. I think they look at mandatory vaccination requirements that were clearly unconstitutional. I think they look at a number of things that are right up there in control of the president.
I think Trump would have done that too. The mandatory.
Pardon me?
Trump would have done that too.
How do you know that?
He's the one who fell for all the Fauci BS. He fell for all the Fauci BS and not being able to use the different drugs.
He did, but I don't think the people around him. I disagree. I don't think the people around him would have done it. But irrespective of that, here we go. Irrespective of that, it doesn't matter. Biden did it. The Biden people did it, and it's consistent with what other things they did. So I think a lot of the election is not looking at necessarily economic issues. It's looking at these much more, in my opinion, much more important cultural issues that are driving a significant portion of the electorate from one party and towards another.
We got a dash, but I'm just, my one statement, because the show now has a whole lot of right-wing people on it, my people around me are that way. The only thing I'm going to warn a little bit, and I don't have to warn you guys. You guys are smarter than me. Just because you think a certain way, don't attribute anything positive to this guy Trump just because he's your guy. He's him. He's himself. He's never going to change. For good or for bad.
I think most of us who think about it, I don't know what, you know, again, who we talk to, but I think most of us who think about it understand that, and we understand that, you know, he's not perfect and he's not the candidate we would pick.
I just, but what I'm saying,
we have a binary choice.
You're right about that, and I'm having a real trouble with that choice myself, to be honest with you. But I mean, I'm saying, don't, at some point, he's going to say something so stupid that you can't, if it's so stupid, you can't just run it under the rug. There's some limit. I mean, my limit with Hillary was when the money got in accounts that weren't her trades. I wouldn't vote for her for dog catcher.
Sure. But stupid is, to quote Forrest Gump, stupid is as stupid does. And Trump says incredibly stupid things. I can pull up any number of Harris comments.
At some point, there has to be a limit of which we're willing to take.
Okay.
I mean, he may not be there yet, but I know people, no matter what he says, he could go out tomorrow and shoot a baby in the street, and it was the baby's fault. I can't go there.
I understand that. The showstoppers, I have about five showstoppers for the Democrats that will make it so that I will never vote for a Democrat unless we see some fundamental change in their party. And it starts with the constitutional crisis and the complete subversion of our constitutional system.
Well, we have to dash it. You know what? I agree with you on all this, what you're talking about.
I know, but I mean, but for me, that's a showstopper. Donald Trump hasn't done anything remotely close to that. Abortion, 9-month birth canal abortion is another showstopper.
Yeah,
for me.
I can't go with that either.
And so that those are showstoppers. And unless the alternative is worse than that, and I have not seen that yet.
Why couldn't the Republicans, which I would be so happy to vote for a moderate Republican, why can't I get one?
Because moderate Republicans lose.
They lose because 20% of the people in this country are haters.
I'd revise that upward.
Maybe. Well, yeah, actually.
I'd revise that
upward.
Here's the terrifying thing, and I'm going to let Dan get on here. It doesn't matter that it's Donald Trump who's the candidate this time around. It could be Ron DeSantis. It could be, look what they did to DeSantis when it looked like he was going to get the nomination. It could be DeSantis. It could be Lindsey
Trump
Graham.
Did it to him.
It could be any of these guys. They will be demonized to the extent that you're seeing Donald Trump being demonized. He just happens to have given him more ammunition, but they will be demonized to the same extent. It doesn't matter, because that's what the other side does. And when you do that,
they end up with guys
like Donald Trump being nominated, because the other people who are moderates and who take nuanced positions lose.
The last gasp of air with you, Lou, we'll get to Dan, is I got a Core Digest thing the other day, and a guy writes, the question was, why is there such political differences between the people and the hatred back and forth? And the answer was very simple. Because we have an awful lot of people in this country that hate everybody else. There's a lot of people that maybe are minorities that hate everybody else because they think they got all the good stuff and they never had a chance. There's other people who think all these minorities, all they do is grab money from everybody else and they don't do anything with it. There is an incredible amount of hate that's just here.
it's been generated. I'm going to point fingers. It's been generated by one side of the political debate that relies on intersectionality as its
how many
basis.
People are not can't stand her because she's black and she's female? All kinds of people.
I don't think there's.
Oh,
very
come
many.
On, Lou. I can name 10 people I know from the South Side, for God's sake.
Well, maybe. I mean, the stuff that I read, and by the way, this is to her credit. She has not bashed the "I am woman, hear me roar" thing very loudly, and I credit her for that. But I haven't heard a big discussion about that. That's you're in Barack Obama.
You're just because you don't hear it, it's not there.
But I would expect to see more of it. And I don't.
It is anyway. SB Future. It's all this stuff continues to simmer. Lou, it never ends. It never ends. Why do you think a rancher in North Dakota can't stand Kamala Harris and her ilk? They don't want any people like that up there.
Because her administration is forcing their daughter to shower with men.
I don't. They wouldn't like her no matter what. SB Futures up 26. The interviews up 183. There are separate groups of people in this country. For some reason, the word melting pot doesn't exactly. They hate each other, and we've always been like that. The only time we've had any kind of come together is when we had a war, when everybody was forced to do something together and figured out the other side wasn't so bad. And we haven't done that in how long?
I don't see it. I don't see it in the commentary, and I don't see it in the literature that I read.
Look underneath the skin a little bit.
I think that's too simple.
I didn't say it was the whole problem. We'll continue this next. By the way, I hope 2 weeks from now we have a winner. I don't know if I can handle a no winner for a year.
We could end up in some real stuff.
Oh God. S&P 2 is up 28. Why don't we go straight to Dan, since he's been waiting to listen to this, unfortunately, for poor Dan. Dan, how are you, buddy?
I'm doing good. How are you?
All right. I know why you wouldn't. This is crazy, isn't it, what we're doing here? But you, since you weren't here last week, has to tell us all about, and the question I asked Lou, which he answered, are we boxed into so much of a corner economically that no matter what anybody wants to do, they won't be able to do it?
I'm not sure about that. You know, I'm not sure about that. I think there's you know, kind of sticking with our side of the business, the investment side of the business. I really think the investing public, if you will, is almost indifferent to the election at this point. I mean, it certainly seems to be the way the markets have been responding. I do think after the first of the year, we're going to see a change, because I think people are going to start focusing more on the issues that are behind this. So I think some of the issues that we've talked about for months and months now, like the deficit and you know, the consumer debt level rising, auto loans, you know, at record highs and all of that, those issues are going to come to the forefront, because during the election process, very interesting, during their campaign process, they haven't addressed those issues. And those are the issues that really matter. Some of the other issues that I think that matter, that neither candidate has really addressed that much, maybe to a small degree, or the average person, or I include myself in that category as the average person, people in the middle class who are paying, looking at their budget and looking at what they're paying for their monthly expenses. And I'm starting to see that now, even with some of my clients taking money out for property taxes, insurance, HOA fees, you know, everything going up, their credit card debt is going up there. So those are the things that I think do matter to most people. And I don't know, I think when it comes to the election, I think there's still some speculation or I don't think people really know which candidate is going to be better for them in the end. I think traditionally Republicans have been better for financial things. I personally don't think Trump is going to be better. I think we're going to see more inflation. I do think that some of the, you know, the, in terms of the economic issues, and all the reporters are saying that the economics are the things that matter here. Well, if they matter so much, why aren't they talking about those issues in the campaign? They seem to be dodging those issues. So I do think that most of the investing public, if you will, is kind of barreling forward, and that's why we're seeing continued movement upward in record highs in the stock market.
Dan, you and I don't remember this, on a show probably 3 months ago, both agreed, we never usually agree on much, we both agreed that none of the issues near and dear to you and I and most of the listeners will ever be discussed in this campaign. And I think we were absolutely correct.
And that's what's a shame of, you know, that's what's too bad about all this. And we're kind of, I think, in some ways, I think a lot of people are giving them too much, you know, the candidates too much, importance, if you will. And I think, fortunately, in our industry, we're really not doing that. We're kind of moving forward. All the CEOs that I talk to, the companies we invest in, seem to be almost indifferent as well. They're wanting to just move forward with, looking at their, you know, managing their companies the best they can in this environment.
I think the big CEOs are very comfortable with the fact that they're in charge.
They are, and that's where it really comes down to. I think that's what
I just look. We just had the, I don't know if you saw this, but the money supply for September, of course, we're always a month behind with these people, just came out. And if you take the 2 month, last month, we're growing at a 5.2 annual rate, which anybody who thinks that's anti-inflationary really needs to get a hemorrhoid or something.
Yeah, no, you've called that one well. And the other one, Chief, that you've called well is the, rates going up on the long end. This has been happening in the background. This is the 30-year being at 4.50 now. It was below 4% not that long ago. It was just a few months ago. And that is significant, because people who have been buying long-term bonds need to understand that it's not a buy and hold to maturity thing. You're going to actually lose value as long rates go up. And I think you're right on the money. You've been right on the money about this all year, that we're likely to see higher rates. Real rate being higher, not really being incorporated into the total rate of, you know, overall rate of interest rate. But I think we're going to see more of that as the year, as the year goes on and into next year. I do think we're going to see a steepening yield curve, which means the shorter maturity bonds are going to give you less yield and less return, and the longer maturity bonds are going to give you a higher yield, and we're going to see higher longer term bond rates continue to increase as shorter term rates come down. And that generally means good news for the economy. I think that's the soft landing we're talking about. But there's a report this morning that came out interviewing CEOs saying that 40% of them are actually not expecting good things in the near term. They're expecting continued softening, which is really what we need to a certain degree to keep inflation down. So that's really where that's the crux of what's going on right now in the markets. I think the people who, like us, who've been in the industry for a long time are looking at it and saying, hey, this overvalued market, if you will, doesn't make any sense. I have my own personal belief about what's happening. I think there's, and I'm starting to see this with friends and kind of more as I get out and network with friends, family, clients. I think the average individual investor has gotten a little bit cocky in here.
Without a doubt.
And to listen to people over and over and over again that I'm meeting say, oh, well, I figured this thing out. I know how to do this. They're in our age group, right? They're at retirement. They've just retired. They're saying, yeah, I can do this. You know, I've put money in the market, and it's really not that hard, is it? And I said, it honestly really isn't that hard. But I would still rather rely on a professional to do it. I would not rely on what I'm finding out on YouTube or just thinking, hey, you know, I'll jump in on Nvidia and the stock will go up and wow, I'm a hero. I know how to do this thing. And I think that is part of the problem with this overvaluation in the market. I think there's been too many people who are thinking they can be do-it-yourselfers.
Let me ask you this, Dan. Simple question that people used to talk about on the trading floor in a laughing way. If everybody bought every day and nobody ever sold, kept your hands in the boat, would we all be richer than all the dreams of avarice?
Yeah, and that's perfect because the rest of what I was going to say is that I've also heard, and you know this as well over the years, that the hardest part for people to know is when to sell. And what's happening is people are just going to hold on and hold on and hold on. And I think they're going to continue to hold on as the market goes down, thinking, yeah, there will eventually be this correction, because they don't have the experience of knowing what it's like to go through a downturn.
Have you run into anybody? I have, actually one of my judge buddies. He was making money as a judge, obviously, putting money in the savings plan and all that kind of stuff. And he expected to have, you know, $1.5 million to retire. Which, if you retire at age 65 and then you're going to take money out to live on, it seems like a lot, but it's not really, right? Because I don't even know if those guys get Social Security. I don't think they do. They probably had another job somewhere.
They have a good pension.
Yeah, a good pension. But what I'm saying is the dude now has like $2.5 million.
Right.
And I said, well, you know, it's so weird. I was talking to one of my attorney buddies last night, and I said, you know, it's so crazy. It's almost like people went to the blackjack table with $100 and they're up five. They almost feel like they can't leave, that somehow they're guilty, that they shouldn't have won five, and they really need to give like two back because they owe it to the place or something.
Right. I absolutely agree.
This guy, he said to me, you know,
but what's coming, guys?
Well, I'm just saying,
if it's inflation, then why not? Why not buy more?
Well, I get that. But inflation, last time we had inflation, the Dow was 800. You know, this is an unusual way inflation works. If inflation drives the 10-year rate to 12% because inflation is 10% like it ought to, you're not going to see people in the market if you can make 10% in the bank. Because, I mean, I've been through this. But my point is he almost, he goes, well, if it goes down to $2 million, what's the difference? It's almost like I didn't deserve the $2.5 million in the first place.
Yeah.
There's a psychology here I'm talking about. It's just like a gambling psychology. Got it. I need to bet the next race because I just made $500 on a horse. I'm somehow guilty of taking money from the track or something, and I better bet the last races just so they can get some money back. If I leave right now, it's unfair or something. It's a weird thing about it, isn't it? I mean, maybe you can describe it better than me.
It's a different mindset than what we have. You know, I think I think the vast majority of people who really still don't totally understand our business also have a mindset of, you know, they have a different view of money and a different, as you're saying, and I agree, and I'm the guy who might, you know, come with the roll of quarters to the casino, and when they're gone, I'm out of there. So that's the I think there is that sense that this is something that was given to me, and I think some people who get inheritances, you know, that they don't expect also feel the same way.
And maybe don't think they even really deserve, you know, it's something.
Yeah, and I think there, again, it goes to understanding, education, experience. That's really what matters. And just as I would hire a contractor to do work on my house rather than doing it myself, because I know this is what they do all day long, again, I think people really need to think about, at this stage, taking some money off the top, you know, taking some money off the table, right? Not betting as much on the next round or on the next game.
There's people that have been. One of the guys I have this discussion with, his father has been, the guy's 90 something. He was a big time guy at Hornblower and Reeks. Remember that name? I mean, the dude's got nothing but dough. Yes. He's been a very successful stockbroker and investor his whole life. He's got the same mentality. What do you mean? I bought it here, and I just have to say, guys, if you open up an account with me for $2.5 million and it's worth $2.5 million the day I get it, that's my number. It's not okay if it goes down to $1 million, I really didn't deserve it. No. you can think that way, but I promise I won't. the fact is it opens up with $2.5 million. My job is to protect and grow the $2.5 million. Well, whether you have some oddball, I'll use the term oddball, feeling that 500 of it really belongs back in the market's hands, I don't know how I can even talk about that.
I think one thing that's important for the listeners to understand as well, and for again, people in our age group, especially the baby boomer age group, who I think as you're approaching retirement, once you get into retirement, there's a magic number that you have in terms of what you can live off of going forward. And it really all comes down to the quality of life you want to have in retirement. And once you reach that magic number, take some off the table, you know, take some out of the market. I met with a friend last week who's a great guy, really smart, originally from Boston, was one of the people that unfortunately suffered from some of the layoffs with IBM, but he realized, hey, you know, I've done really well in the market. He goes, I tend to be an aggressive investor. And I said, that's been perfect. Now's the time to lighten up. And he really did listen to me. And I think it's good that he heard what I was saying. And I kind of went back to, here's the amount of money that you've accumulated for retirement. And now at this point, you have to decide, are you okay? Are you comfortable with the lifestyle you'll have in retirement? And at some point, you just got to say, okay, I'm taking it off the table. Rather than, you know, thinking of it like as a game, you know, going forward, I'm going to continue to do this. I'm going to continue to remain aggressive. You just have to go back to the basics of once you retire and once you're approaching retirement, you have to start thinking about preserving your capital and what you're going to live off of in the future and what you're going to pass on to your kids if that's important to you as well.
Dan, if we live to be 150, which I don't think we will unless somebody comes up with some elixir, we're going to look back on the years from 2008, especially the last 5 years, as the biggest outlier in terms of market movement, with people just pouring money in, almost like Argentina. And instead of saying, God, thank you very much, I never believed I'd have this kind of money, let's now protect it. It's not what people are thinking. If it goes down, 90% of the people are going to give it right back. And we used to call the U-turn. And I know my clients don't feel that way, and I know yours don't, but
you know, I, a lot of people. I mean, name me these big investment houses that even talk about protection or anything. It's nothing. It's it, they think the last 5 years this is the way it's going to be forever. They may be right. They may be right another year or two or five or ten. But I don't see Microsoft at, you know, 100 times revenue. Do you? I mean, maybe. You know, but I don't see it there. I mean, it could very well. I could be, you know, the old Luddite. Somewhere, someplace along there, you got to, I'm not saying sell it, protect it, do something with it.
Right, exactly. Yeah, preserve that, you know, like, right, exactly. Realize the gains that you've made at some point and capture some of what you've worked hard for. You know, and that's usually the way I word it with prospective and current clients, you know, who are, you know, retiring. Let's preserve what you have and then move forward from here. So it doesn't mean you're out of the market. It means that you have maybe a little bit less exposure going forward to especially the big five or the big seven names. There could be something that happens. I do think after the first of the year, there's going to be a awakening up. I think people are going to start looking at what's happening, especially in terms of the deficit. And also, like I said, I'm already seeing it at the level of people trying to make ends meet, you know, people taking money out of IRAs to pay property taxes, those kind of things. So there has to be some sort of a correction, if you will, or and hopefully we don't have a major event that drives the market down significantly, but I do think that a correction has been long in order, and I do think the cliche, if you will, that the market does well during election years is true. You know, it really has over history done very well during election years, but this year is coming, you know, will be coming to an end soon.
Well, if these guys continue to pump money in, you know, I don't make too many predictions. They keep pumping money in.
Yes.
We're going to, the inflation, despite them lying about it, is going to come flying right back. And if they don't do the same thing they did before, which neither you or I would recommend, run around and buy every long-term bond they can so the prices don't go down, we're going to see a 10-year in a 7 or 8, 9% range. But if inflation goes back up to 5%, the 10-year is not going to be 1.5% this time, unless they do what they did last time and buy everything out there.
You know, Druckenmiller is short 20% of his entire portfolio in bonds.
Really?
Yeah. He said, I've got 20% of my portfolio short bonds, and if I was younger, I would have done more.
Well, you know, I'll say this, though, Greg. If you were doing the show 5 years ago, you know, I would have said, and I think Dan would have agreed, that the single most obvious trade other than buying it in 1981, the market, was to short these bonds. Yet if you shorted them with the Fed buying them like they were doing, I think I shorted them 15 times for my people.
You know, buy or buy not, there is no short.
No, what I'm saying is, the government would all of a sudden start buying them, and they bought what, $5 trillion worth of them.
Exactly.
So there were,
buy or buy not, there is no short.
Yeah, and I'm saying it's. I probably got it. I'm going to say, with all those trades, I mean, obviously Dan and Greg, if we would have, with us trying to sail, it probably would have taken us 5 years to get around the world because I don't know how to sail.
Yeah.
If we did that, if we just shorted them, the TLT at 175, wherever the hell it got up to, and just left. And now it's like, where the hell is it? The TLT is 92. Yeah, we'd be up $80. But every single time it looked like they were started to move, I'm going to say I'm up a little bit on those trades. But some of them, it looked like it was starting to go. I got short that stuff. I bought a put spread or something. I just got short them. And I probably got, out of 15 times I did it, I got stuck where the sun don't shine at least 7. I probably was up a little bit, but they would go out, and all of a sudden there'd be a big buy the next day, or European guys would go out and buy, drive it even further in negative territory. You couldn't compete with that.
I don't know. You're still talking about shorting. I'm just saying.
Well, shorting the bond is buying the interest rate, right?
Not really.
What do you mean?
I mean, if you've got $1 million coming in every year, you're either buying stuff or you're not buying stuff.
What I'm saying is, if you think interest rates are going higher, you short the bonds.
Or you buy the market.
Buy the market.
Yeah, I think that, you know, longer bonds, that's definitely, that would apply to, like 10 years and longer, 10 years, 30 years. Definitely not short on the short end of the curve.
No,
so
no,
I wouldn't,
the Fed
I think
controls
that. We're going to have the opposite effect. You could still actually, you want to stay long on the short end. And so, yeah, you could do that sort of reverse trade where you're shorting the long end of the market and you're buying the short end of the market in here. So that barbell trade, if you will, I think would make sense. And that would also give you, you know, some balance in your portfolio, your fixed income
portfolio.
Well,
the TLT, if the 10-year rate goes to 10% or 8%, the TLT is going to be 70, not 92.
Right. And the other thing, too, in terms of the market that a lot of people aren't aware of is buyers are, you know, when you look at foreign, you know, buyers overseas, people look at the U.S. bond market as a place of stability, a flight to quality. So if there are things that happen, people will start buying the market and that will take rates back down again. And there is, you know, the bond market responds the same way the equity market does as well. So there's a fair number of foreign buyers who have stepped out of the market for temporarily, or maybe their economies like Europe are doing a little bit better, but they're not buying as much as they have. Now, say some geopolitical event happens, I think people will start buying T-bills, treasury bonds across the curve.
Well, you can only, I mean, how safe are the guys that bought them with negative interest rates and now they're sitting in their account worth 40 cents on the buck?
Right, exactly.
I mean, that's not, yeah, I guess you're safe, but you're broke, right?
Yeah, there is risk, and I think that's an important thing for listeners to know, that there is risk to buying bonds anywhere from 2 years out. You're going to be dealing with what's called interest rate risk, and it's a very hard concept to understand, but as rates go higher, the price of your bonds drop. One thing, too, Chief, that I want to point out, because I've had this discussion with clients and friends recently, what do you do as short rates are coming down? And fortunately, there are people who understand this is the one time that I would say it's okay to buy CDs. If you can lock in a 5% rate, if you have locked in a 5% rate, it's a good time to be doing that. But I also want to point out the distinction between buying a CD and buying a treasury bill, no short term. I'm talking on the short term. You can sell the T-bill. You can trade it, which is what we do. You can buy it at a certain price and sell it at another price, just like a stock. With a CD, you're locked in. So should you need that money, there, you know, it doesn't have liquidity, or may allow you to take it out one time, or some money out one time. T-bills are a much better purchase as far as I'm concerned, because you can trade them. So a lot of people have the misconception that you have to hold a bond to maturity, and you don't. I mean, that's what we do all day long, is we trade bonds. So there is a way to make money in the trading part of fixed income, just as there is with equities, with stocks.
I would say, Dan, it depends on how long the CD is and what the penalties are to get out.
Absolutely.
I mean, if you're going to get 5.2% for a year and it's, you know, 20% of your money and you're retired, go for it.
Yeah, absolutely.
But if it's 5 years and you owe them like 20% to get out, I don't think any of that egregious, then I'm saying, whoa, on that.
And the other thing, too, about T-bills and bonds, you know, government bonds, you know, treasury bonds, is that they're very liquid. So right now we're in a period where there's a lot of liquidity in the market, right? And as you've been saying, there's a lot of money that's being pumped in, which is keeping liquidity up. And that's another thing that people aren't aware of. But once that liquidity starts to dry up at some point, it's going to be a lot more difficult to sell. There's going to be a wider spread between your offer and your bid, you know, where you can buy the bonds and where you can sell them. And that will happen eventually. It hasn't yet happened in high yield bonds. It is the case in municipal bonds because they're not as liquid. The good thing about municipals is you're able to lock in a really good yield right now. You can still get double A bonds if you do your homework, which we do, for five, you know, with the 5%. And then if you're thinking about your after tax return, you're more like 7.5%. So there are still some good opportunities in municipal bonds. There are still corporate bonds we've been buying as well, because, you know, on the short end, you can get 6, 6.5, 7% on money good bonds. So there's, you know, if you're looking for a way to pick up yield, this is still a good environment with corporates. If you have an IRA, and with municipals, if you have a taxable account.
Well, Dan, I think for real quick, hang with me here and kick me if I'm wrong, but I think for the listeners, when we talk about bands, and Dan uses the term somewhat interchangeably, but when you do the government stuff, you're not really buying a band. A band is what, 10 years and over? You're buying.
Right. So when you buy, right, exactly.
Well, let me finish. You're buying it as.
T-bills. Yeah. Treasury bills are 1 year and under, and then 2 to 10 is notes. Treasury notes, and then longer would be bonds. So 10 and longer would be bonds.
I have a question that I should absolutely know the answer to. I'm going to ask you in a second, but it's like when we go, my brother will go to auction, or Dan likes to get them more on the market where he buys them, but. When you buy a T-bill, or we go to auction and purchase a T-bill for a client, it's going to return, I'll use the term, $1,000 at the end of 3 months. The money you pay for it, you pay less than that, okay? So if it's 5%, it's going to be, what, 0.975 or something you're paying for it, correct?
Exactly.
So somewhere in there, 974, 976. So we're going to buy it for you at that price. You're never going to get a check from the government for interest. The end of 3 months, the thing is now worth $1,000. And if you did the math, you made the 5%, or I think we might have got 4.8 this Monday, Dan. Does that sound right? 4.75, something like
yes.
that.
Yes. Yeah, that's good. Yeah.
So when we say all of a sudden, if the market or you get an idea that you really like a stock or something or an ETF, if that happens 2 weeks from now, I guess the rates could go up so much that we have to sell that for a loss, but I don't think it's ever happened, at least recently. We're going to sell that for the same or slightly more than we just bought it for yesterday. So you haven't lost anything. It's not like a CD. I mean, you lost the interest for 8 days is all you lost. There's no risk on the thing. I mean, the biggest risk is the rates went to the moon. You just have to wait 90 days to get your $1,000. But there's no. I mean, there's no risk at all. That's why we like to do it. And if you want to buy a stock and you want to use all the money that's in a T-bill here at PTI, my brother, how long does it take him to sell it, Dan? As time as he picks up the phone, he says, sell a bond and buy the stock. It's just like that, right?
Yeah, it's instantaneous.
We're doing
those trades all day long.
Yeah. Now my question to you: when does
it's a good source of liquidity? T-bills have been an excellent source of liquidity, and the other point that you make about it, when you buy them at a discount, there is an interest. The interest is actually built into the discount that you have.
Right.
That amount of interest is going to be tax deductible for your state tax. So you're getting, you know, depending on where you live, you're going to get an additional tax break from buying treasuries. So that I think a lot of people also aren't aware of. That's another advantage.
Dan, when do you I should know this. It's been a while since I took my Series 7. When do they start sending you the interest check? Is it 10 years?
Well, if that's what that, you know, I don't know that they do that as much anymore. You can. When you open an account, or you know, say that we're working on an account, you can either have the interest reinvested, right?
No, what I'm saying, I know a 30-year bond. If I buy that, I'm actually going to get a check.
Yeah, well, if you're an individual and you want it, if that's how you want it, if you want that money, you know, if you want to hold that money, you would get paid twice a year. You get the
right.
interest.
Every I'm saying,
six
well,
months.
How far
it would
out?
Be after, and you're right. It would be 10 years and longer. It would be with the bond.
I'll say so if they come out with a 7-year. That's at a discount, just like the 3 and the 6.
No. Actually, a 7-year, you would still get the. You could work at that. You would get the check. Otherwise, what you would do? Say you open an account and you just have one bond in it. That money would get reinvested. So you can like whatever the interest rate is, or it would just get. It would show up as cash in your account, and then you can withdraw it as
I get cash. The question is when is it implied interest? Like in the T-bill, you just buy it at a discount, and when do you? Actually buy it and they send you the interest.
It won't be anything longer than a year.
Okay.
Because after that you're getting your interest. So say it's a 6% coupon, you know, the interest rate is 6%. You get paid 3% in January or whatever month, you know, that it's been issued, and then 3% again in July, 6 months later.
Right, so the answer is notes you get a check to. The bills you don't.
Yeah, as soon as you get over, basically as soon as you get over a year, you're going to start getting interest.
Oh, the guys from FINRA aren't listening. Tell me the guy better take his test again.
Well, what I'm saying also that I think is important is there's something called reinvestment, and this
right.
there's you reinvest the money, it's going to be at the same rate, the current rate that you're, you know, the I don't know, let's say you buy a 7 year, like you're saying, it would be wherever the 7 year is trading at that time, and that's going to be a reinvestment rate. And there is something called reinvestment rate risk, which is if you're planning on reinvesting and interest rates are going down, then you're actually there is a risk that you're going to be getting less.
Well, every time, or you could just tell us every time you get an interest check, put in a T-bill.
Yeah, exactly.
You don't have to invest it in the same thing you had.
You don't have to, absolutely. Or like you're saying, you can put it in the stock market. The fact that short-term rates are coming down, that's the other thing that has fueled the tech sector, because short rates, as interest rates go down, the cost of capital to companies goes down as well. And it's especially true of tech companies. So that's another factor that's been very positive for tech. Our concern, again, as we've been mentioning most of the year, is just we're almost looking at this as an overvalued market, a speculative market. As growth slows in the market, the demand will slow as well. And I don't think we have enough data yet. If we've been following the earnings reports that have come out for the third quarter, and some companies have done well. I think Tesla finally is profitable, but not a company I would recommend, but it's a there's been a trend towards decent earnings. I'd say most of the companies are reporting as good as expectations or better. And then of course there are situations that are unique. IBM was one. There's a tech company that has had some issues with their the consulting division, their financial division. So there's you really have to look at specific companies. One trend we've seen this year, and we talked about it when we first started the call about the do-it-yourselfers, is that you could buy almost anything. You could buy the ETF this year, and that's really what I would have recommended for people who want to maintain. I mean, that's what we do as well right now, because there isn't as much differentiation, and because you can with an ETF like an SPY or a VTI, Vanguard's Total Stock Index, you can get exposure to the whole market. So this is not a year necessarily that has been stock-specific investing. So you could have made a lot of money in NVIDIA, but if you weren't sure where to put your money, you could do really well. You could have done really well this year in a index ETF, like an S&P 500 ETF, like the SPY, or the Vanguard Total Stock Index, the VTI, which I tend to prefer because it's, the fees on the ETF are lower and you get a very broad exposure. That trend will change, and I'm expecting it to change next year, where we're going to go back to the active management and the stock specific. You want to be in certain stocks or certain industries. I think next year will be more of that kind of year. This year has been generic. You could be in an ETF, you could be in the broad market and have done very well.
How many times are we going to believe this guy's BS that in 6 months everything is going to be driverless cars and they're all going to be Teslas? We believe this how many times now?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. I think there's what we do that's unique is we do a lot of research on the companies, and I really get most of my information on from the CEOs. Most of the important information that we get is really talking to the companies and finding out what you read in an article. You have to be really careful because you can read two different articles talking about the same company, the same stock, that can have very different points of view. This is what I grew up with. This is what I started with in the mid-80s when I started in the industry, is going through research reports from Wall Street and trying to decide, which recommendation makes more sense and which point of view makes more sense. But what we do is we actually look at the companies themselves and make that determination on our own. So we're listening to everything else and we're hearing all the different recommendations, but we're also coming up with our own recommendation. So people have to be able to do it yourself is listening to a recommendation, the buy recommendation, and just buying on that, because that analyst might be a brand new analyst to the industry. That that report may not incorporate every every point of view. It's just one one viewpoint.
Dan, what do you make of it? You don't have to answer this if you don't want to, but maybe Greg would like to opine. What do you make of a guy? Now, you know, I know that my thoughts are always clouded by my upbringing, maybe my nationalities, Irish and Italian. What do you think? Now, I know where I am on this. You can probably guess. What do you think of a guy that gets $9.2 billion is the total in government help this guy's gotten, this Musk, basically from the Obama administration going forward, and now he's got his nose firmly up Trump's behind? I mean, what does that say to you? I sit there and go,
stay away from Tesla, stay away from X, you know, his investments.
I mean, where do these people grow up?
Yeah, I agree with, no, I totally agree with you on that as well. I think there's a certain, it kind of tarnishes our industry, or tarnishes, you know, corporate America, if you will, to see this kind of thing happening. It's, unfortunately, it's the case, I think, that some people who have a lot of money are able to, you know, to do these things, and people that have come from the elite, it doesn't necessarily mean that they're smarter or better. They just have the money to work with to earn more money. And some of the decisions they make, I agree with you 100% on coming from a somewhat similar background, that you want to have a little bit of, you know, you want to make sure things are being done in the right way and not you know, sort of taking advantage of wherever you can get your funding and then moving forward, because in the end that'll catch up with you.
Why doesn't, I mean, this is a little off topic here, but maybe it isn't. As you know, you've heard me say, although you probably can't tell by the show itself, my theme for the show really is that everything sort of depends on everything else, and it's so much more tied together. And I got that view, Dan, when I was in grad school at University of Chicago, and you're slugging along in accounting, and you're slugging along in finance, and you're slugging along in marketing, you know, kind of at the grad level. One day you wake up, you're like Belushi and Dan Aykroyd when they saw the light, when the nuns spanked them down the stairs. I've seen the light. One day you wake up and you go, at some level, all three of these subjects are the same subject. You can't have one without the other. They all dovetail. If the marketing guy doesn't know how much the thing costs to make and doesn't know what the profit stuff is, doesn't know how the company's doing, doesn't know the overhead rates, he can't price it properly. If the finance guy doesn't know the marketing piece and what those guys are doing and what they're marketing, he can't price anything out properly. The accounting guy, if he's got nothing to put down is his beans, there's no beans to put down. If they don't dovetail together, none of them work.
Totally agree. And I think and to take it to a different level, I think there's been more of, you know, we have to kind of dovetail, if you will, the whole world at this point. We have to kind of look at things from a global point of view and how everything is interrelated, and at some point, you know, we want to reach an equilibrium, and that's what economics is all about. But in terms of what you're saying, in terms of how a company is run, I agree with you that all of those levels are important. And what I'll say is that what really makes a difference is the people running the show. It's whoever is, you know, the senior management is really what is going to drive companies. That's our philosophy, that there's a lot to those different aspects of a business are going to work best if you have a good leader.
But why, when you look back and you say, why should you and I, if we went out and bought a basic Ford or Chevy pick-me-up, why the hell should we have been, for the last 10 years or 15 years, been sending Musk a check every time we bought that truck? I mean, what possessed us to do that? Where all of a sudden I have to pay more, or some poor guy on a farm that can barely make it, he's got to pay $500 a truck to send a check to this guy? How did he benefit? I mean, what are we doing here?
And now all of a sudden
the guy wants to run the place.
Yep, I absolutely agree with you. It's and that's why I do think we have to look at who is running the show. You know, when we're making decisions about how we invest money or how we make any investment, right? I mean, any investment that you make has to be led by who's in charge, who's running the show, who's managing the company. And he is somebody I personally do not have a, you know, a high opinion of, in terms of somebody I would give money to.
I don't think we'd have. I don't think we'd have.
The other thing about him that I think we have to be careful. You have to be careful about when you're investing in.
I don't know. He's pretty good at making it.
Well, $9.2 billion we gave him.
Yeah, I mean, but I think that's different than if you're an investor looking at coming in and you know sort of taking a part of that. You have to be willing to deal with because there's going to be some erratic moves, you know, in the stock price, which there have been in the companies that he runs. You also, I think, to a certain degree, if you were, you know, I was the chief investment officer of Foundation, you're looking at, you know, a certain type of company, or you're looking at companies that are, you know, over the long term are not only good investments, but are also doing something good for mankind, right? They're, and those are the companies that tend to do well with, they have a corporate culture that is, where they take care of their employees, where they, you know, those are the companies that are generally the long lasting ones. The concern I have about Musk is he's splintered. He's got a number of different businesses, the SpaceX, the X, the Tesla. And not to say that they haven't done well, and not to say that he hasn't had a good vision with some of his insights. It's just that at some point you have to decide. I would prefer to have somebody who's focused on a particular business, who's running the show, and as you mentioned earlier, Chief, who's looking at, you know, the different aspects of the business, and frankly is treating their employees well, because the employees are more likely to stick around if you know, the good employees are going to be attracted to those companies and they're going to stick around for a lot longer.
Well, Dan, you know, and obviously Greg knows because he does some stuff with us at PTI, that we've been, I'll admit it, early but long, the metals in the last few months have been, you know, spectacular, really, for people.
And really well. Silver.
Now, so my brother goes, what do you want to do with this stuff? And I said, well, here's what I want you to do. I want you to not touch it as it goes up every day, and then the day before it goes down, let's protect the hell out of it.
Yeah.
But no, of course, that's a joke. But how do you do that? But you and I are talking about how we think the Fed is putting more money in the system. They're protecting this wealth bubble. It's damn obvious. I mean, it's not like you and I are creating new ground here. But we also know that at some point the prices are going to get incredibly high to where any little glitch and they're unsustainable. I'm not saying they're there yet or will be there a month from now, but if the trend is, you know, if the market is up another 70% in the next 2 years, 80%, 100%, whatever, at some point, even with the money going into the system, the inflation's going to cause 10-year rate. There are like two ships passing in the night, and we know there's a collision course someplace. How do you have any idea when it's going to be and what's going to cause it? Hopefully it's not a war or something, but what is it, something we can't even think of? Is it somebody happening?
It's probably something we can't even think of or that we're not thinking of right now, and that's what has happened. I mean, who thought about COVID, right? I mean, that was a glitch in the system. People were thinking about subprime loans back in, you know, 06, 07, 08, when we had the major financial crisis. People back in the late 80s were thinking about increased levels of debt with the S&L crisis, with a huge amount of debt. The 80s were a time of growth, a period of growth. And by the late 80s, early 90s, we were starting to see that too much leverage, too much financial leverage is not good. What I will say about companies in general is that they've learned their lesson from the late 80s and early 90s, and that their balance sheets, most companies' balance sheets are stronger, and we're not seeing default rates it's been a positive thing that we're not seeing default rates, because I think a lot of corporate management has learned their lesson from what happened in the late 80s. So there are some positive trends in terms of how companies are managing their balance sheets.
I would agree 100%.
There will be an event. There's no question there'll be an event that will.
Well, we had COVID, and Fed poured money, and it was a big buy.
I mean, it was a very short-lived correction, and it was oil prices dropping, you know, precipitously, and then.
Well, we were in an 18-month depression, and the market went up every day.
Right, it's you know, there is money out there, and that's the thing.
Well, the Fed put money out there. The Fed created $4 trillion. That's money. Right.
There's, again, my viewpoint on looking at speculation and industries, looking at like the potential growth down the road, which is what a lot of analysts do in the tech industry, I still have the concern that it isn't going to be it shouldn't be necessarily up in a straight line. There's going to be some bumps along the road, and even if the trend, and like let's use AI as an example, the trend is positive because there's a lot of uses for AI, but it isn't going to be there's also going to be some hiccups along the way, and it could be that some of these trends that we've had in recent years are short-lived. So,
well, it's a lot different than 2000. Well, there's similarities and there's differences. I mean, 2000 was the dot-com thing, but there were a lot of companies that had basically nothing, right? So they could go from 100 to zero, and you're like, well, why were they ever 100? But there are similarities in the sense that the QQQ had just started, and people were pouring money into the indexes, and the same five stocks were getting bought every single day by people who didn't even know they were buying them, which is sort of like now. So you have a big difference in the valuation of those stocks versus other stocks. Same thing you do now, I think, with the big seven here, or the big six. Now, so that's kind of a worrisome similarity. But like you say, I don't see a lot of stocks around that are making no money, that all of a sudden could be worth nothing. I think their balance sheets. But I don't know if you read Coke's yesterday. Coke was up. Their earnings were higher. And they came flat out and said it. Sales are down. And well, by the way, we raised prices more than the sales were down, so revenue was up. How long can that continue? I don't see any really, really bump in the road here at all.
It's really the next generation that's going to make that decision, right? It's not us and the baby boomer generation. It's the next generation who are looking to buy purchase homes where there's dual income. And I'm looking at my niece and her husband that have fantastic jobs, but they're still struggling to afford a house in a city. It's the trend of people moving back into being required to come back to the office. And now they've moved out an hour away from the city where they lived, or a couple hours away, and they're having to leave their job. So I think it's important, for the future to look at what's happening at the younger generations that are coming along, and they're the ones who are really going to propel what happens going forward. And their viewpoint is quite different than ours, in the sense that we're not looking to buy our first home. We're not struggling with the day-to-day costs the way that they are, but they're the ones who are going to be the ones that make the decisions going forward. They're the ones who are going to, they're going to say, hey, this is too much, I'm not willing to pay this, and it's going to change the trend that we've seen. And I believe that's going to happen. It won't happen overnight, but I think that's going to happen over time.
Well, I hope it's not any kind of single event, because I sure as hell don't want to go through that again. I've done that a couple times. But I mean, the thing that's kind of different than now than in the 2000, so far now, is if we had an event like COVID, which is the single biggest event, God, in our lifetime. It's bigger than a war. It's bigger than anything, right? What it did to the market, what it did to the economy. You had, say Apple. I'll just pick this out. Apple's trading 230. And there's nothing bad about Apple's as a company. You might think they're too much antitrust or whatever. The fact is, they're a pretty freaking good company. They're making all kinds of money. They got all kinds of cash. But the weird part is, their PE is higher than kind of it's not ever been, but pretty close. Same thing with Microsoft. Same thing with some of these places. Nvidia, for sure. The weird part was in 2000, Dan, and you remember this, but maybe not this specific part. Somebody, all of a sudden, Microsoft, instead of 426, is 200. Well, now the Fed will react, everybody will react and say, my God, this is a screaming buy down here. And, now it's down to, 8 times revenue instead of 13 or something. And all of a sudden it goes flying back up again, and you have the same phenomenon you did in 2020 with the COVID, right? The biggest buy opportunity you got in the world. But in 2020, people looked at it and go, God, who's the idiot ever paid 426? This thing is worth 200.
Right.
I mean, I don't see any of that yet to where, no, people don't think these things are high. I mean, maybe they keep growing.
I think it goes back to the not having the experience that we had, in 87, and, going back to the periods of correction and looking at stocks and the market as a whole being overvalued, not really understanding that or appreciating it. There will be, you know, for baby boomers too, the other trend is that they won't be receiving as much income in retirement as they receive. They might be receiving a lot of investment income, but their income will eventually be fixed once they retire. And I think as that trend continues going forward, there may be less, you know, less disposable income, if you will. But you're right. I mean, it's a similar trend to what happened in the 80s, where there was like a snowball effect. And I don't know if greed necessarily is the word to use. And I think that's really, if you want to get really philosophical, I think the question is this market driven by greed? I don't know to the same degree that it was in the 80s.
Well, I still, if I could figure out what caused the crash in 29 to happen that week and not the week before or after. Same right. thing in 87. The difference in 87 of 2 days would have made me one of the wealthiest guys in Chicago instead of one of the most broke.
A huge
difference. And I honestly can't tell you why and when it happened in 2000. I know the Fed backed up a little bit on their money supply because of the Y2K stuff, but there was no massive event that I can remember that all of a sudden Cisco's 65 and all of a sudden it's 6. I mean, that was a hell of a comeuppance.
A big difference. You know, I think the other thing that you mentioned, going back again to something you mentioned early on that I think was really significant when you were talking about people feeling, you know, individuals feeling a little bit of guilt about taking money off the table, and that I think is true, because I think it's, to a certain degree, there are people who have put money into the market and taken the money they've made and put it back in. And I think, and to a certain degree, they think it might not be, quote, American, or it might not be, you know, prudent, you know, in terms of, you know, to take money out now or to sell some. And so I would agree, maybe from a more, you know, kind of trying to keep an optimistic view of people and say that, you know, people are really just wanting to continue to fuel what's going on because they want to see, you know, growth in our economy and all that. So it may be, that might be some of the behavioral things that are going on right now currently in
well, if bad things are going to happen to everybody, you got to let the good things happen too.
Absolutely.
I was just thinking, talking about something stupid, I was just thinking, what if the three of us decide, oh, you know, Chicago's kind of a, oh boy, dying city almost, and nobody wants a cab medallion. What if we went out and bought 10 cab medallions, we're trading like next to nothing, and all of a sudden LA says, we really don't want the Olympics and it's coming to Chicago. All of a sudden, what do you think, those would like triple in a day, ooh, wouldn't they? You know, sometimes you just got to be in the right place. You know,
yeah. And unfortunately, there aren't a whole lot of undervalued opportunities right now. The whole market is being taken up here. But I totally agree with you.
Sometimes you got to let the good stuff happen, because guess what? The bad stuff will happen.
It will happen. I agree.
Take care, buddy. Greg, thank you very much. Good job as usual. SP Futures up 26. NASDAQ futures up 170. We're bouncing back pretty big from yesterday. We're not up as far as we were down yet, but we could get there. Back tomorrow, Stocks and Jacks.
That's all, folks.